This is Diana Cordy with Book Talk. My guest is former Senator George Mitchell. His newest book, a memoir, is The Negotiator. Welcome to our program.
Thanks for having me.
You've done so many things, among them, Senator from Maine, federal judge, the primary architect of the 1998 Good Friday Agreement for Peace in Northern Ireland, and U.S. Special Envoy for Middle East Peace. And outside of government, you've worked with many organizations, including the Red Cross after 9/11. What was your role with them?
The Red Cross raised quite a lot of money immediately following the 9/11 disaster, and they encountered some problems and internal difficulties over how and where that money would be allocated. So their board asked me to serve as the independent overseer of the distribution of the funds. It turned out to be well over $1 billion. And I spent overall several months, the better part of a year, reviewing and meeting with the victims and survivors and families of those lost and many other organizations, and devised a plan for the distribution of that money, as I said, over $1 billion to people who'd been affected by 9/11.
When did you first become a negotiator?
I think it happened about the time I entered the Senate. I had been a practicing lawyer, United States attorney, and a federal district court judge in Maine before that. So I had some experience, but incidental to my main task. But when I became Senate Majority Leader, that's a tough job and one that requires constant negotiation, morning, noon, and night, to try to move things along in the Senate, which, as you can see from the daily news, is no easy task. So I didn't have any academic experience with it, but it was mostly trial and error and formed primarily during my tenure as Senate Majority Leader.
I imagine the Majority Leader is the one who needs the skill, right?
Well, you need a lot. Patience is one of them. The Senate is set up in such a way that it's relatively easy to obstruct and prevent things from happening. It's quite difficult to get anything to actually pass. And each senator has the ability to prevent or obstruct things from happening for certainly some period of time. And getting them all to go along can be a difficult task, but I enjoyed it. It was meaningful. We did some good things, and I got a lot of experience from it.
Why was the Senate set up like that? Was it intentional?
Oh, yes, of course. It's a part of the broader scheme of the Constitution. The 45 men who gathered in Philadelphia in the summer of 1787 to write the American Constitution had lived their entire lives under a British king, and they did not want there ever to be an American king. We can see now with the perspective of hindsight that they succeeded. We've had 45 presidents and no kings. The mechanism that they used to achieve their objective was to divide power, to create tensions among those who held power, to prevent any one individual, group, institution, or body from gaining total power and authority in our society. So they made it hard to get things done. And on the theory that only those things that had a lot of support should be enacted into law. And the Senate is, in effect, a microcosm of that principle.
Boy, it certainly is. When you're asked to settle a dispute, whether it's the troubles in Northern Ireland or the Middle East, what's the first thing that you do?
Study, do my homework. Find out everything I can about the issues, the history, the personalities, the problems. Hopefully try to discover the bottom line for each side in the conflict. When I went to Northern Ireland, I had never been there. I had been to the Republic of Ireland only once for about 2 days, had never been to Northern Ireland. I had a general and vague familiarity with the history of the problem, but I immediately established a reading list. I read in total 30 to 40 books over the span of the 5 years that I was there, the history of the conflict. I made it a point to go meet, visit, and talk with each of the principal participants, the political leaders of Northern Ireland and the United Kingdom and the Republic of Ireland. So the first thing is to study and make sure you know what you're getting into.
Why was Northern Ireland is so important that President Clinton sent you as the envoy?
It's a long-standing conflict, which really, by some accountings, is about 800 years old. That's the time, way back in the 12th or 13th century, when Britain achieved dominance over the island of Ireland, which before that had been a number of small kingdoms with constant warfare between them. Britain assumed control, began the active transplantation of people to Ireland, that is, settlement of Ireland, about the same time that the same British cabinet, in fact, that authorized the settlement of North America here, what we now think of as the United States. We mark our founding as Jamestown at 1607, and the so-called plantation of Ireland occurred in about 1609, that is, people moving from Britain and Scotland to Ireland to take over there. So the conflict has gone on for a really very long time with some horrific results, many people killed, a lot of people injured and maimed, and a great deal of fear and anxiety. No American president before Bill Clinton would touch the problem because it was seen as impossible of solution and politically difficult. Britain is now, of course, one of our closest friends and allies, our mother country, on one side, and Ireland, which is a source of so much immigration in the United States, there are now an estimated 30 million Americans with some Irish heritage. So politically, it was too difficult that nobody touched it, not John F. Kennedy, not Ronald Reagan, both of whom had Irish ancestry. Bill Clinton, on the other hand, waded right in. He full force and appointed me. He said to me, "You're leaving the Senate as Senate Majority Leader. I keep telling people this is important to me. If you go there at my request, it'll be a symbol of how important I think it is." And that's one of the reasons I went and did it.
So why was the Irish Accord successful, but there's never any peace in the Middle East?
No two circumstances are alike. Indeed, no two people are alike. There are 7.5 billion people on Earth, and each one is a unique and different individual, and so are each of the conflicts. While there are some surface similarities, religion, territorial dispute, national identity, economic difficulties, each is the product of its own unique history, and each requires a unique local solution. I spent 5 years working in Northern Ireland, in one managing three separate sets of discussions. I did two tours of duty in the Middle East, totaling about 3 or 4 years, and they're quite different. It's more complicated in the Middle East. There are more external factors, more internal disputes. There's no Iran involved in Northern Ireland, an external country that whose policies and objectives affect the conflict, as is the case in the Middle East. While there were religious differences between Catholics and Protestants, in the Middle East it's much more complicated. You have within Islam both the conflict between Sunnis and Shia, which dates back to the death of the Prophet Muhammad in the 7th century, but you also have many internal conflicts within each of those groupings. So in the Middle East, I think it's fair to say tougher, more deeply rooted, more complicated and difficult.
Would you call it impossible?
No, I don't think there's such a thing as an impossible ending to a conflict. I think conflicts are conducted, they're created, they're sustained by human beings, they can be ended by human beings. And I think this one will. It's going to take longer, obviously. We've now had, I think, about a dozen presidents, 20 secretaries of state, a whole bunch of Israeli and Arab leaders who've tried their hand at it, none with success so far, but it's going to happen because it's so much in the interest of Israelis and Palestinians, each of them, to settle the dispute. And I think they will do so in time. Now, that won't resolve all the raging conflicts in the Middle East, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, the whole gamut of difficulty and conflict. That, I think, is going to spread over a long period of time.
When you say over a long period of time, you're talking decades.
Yes, I am, and it's not unusual. Here in the United States, in a much simpler time, a much simpler set of circumstances, 8 years elapsed following the end of the fighting in our revolution and the establishment of the United States government. In France, 50 years elapsed between the time of their revolution and the establishment of their constitutional republics as they now exist, and Britain even longer. So we shouldn't expect the Arab world to achieve stability instantly or in a period of time less than has occurred in the Western world in much simpler times. And I think it's going to be difficult. There will be some setbacks viewed from our perspective and measured by our standards. There will be some successes. But they're going through a period following the collapse of a political order that was established after the First World War. And it's going to take a long time to sort it out with, I think, some serious adverse consequences along the way.
What do you suppose would be the trigger for such a settlement?
Well, first, it's personal trust. That's lacking now. I spent a lot of time with Prime Minister Netanyahu and a lot of time with President Abbas of the Palestinian Authority. Unfortunately, I think there's not a good relationship between them. In my estimation, Prime Minister Netanyahu does not believe that President Abbas has the political or personal strength to enter into an agreement and to see that it's implemented. And so he doesn't think a process is going to work, and therefore why should he take any political risks and incur a lot of criticism in his society? President Abbas, on the other hand, doesn't believe that Prime Minister Netanyahu is serious. He thinks he doesn't really want an agreement and that he just says enough to placate the United States, which is pushing for a settlement. But he doesn't believe an agreement is going to happen for that reason. So both of them are unwilling to take any political risk, and there is substantial political risk to them because both societies are deeply divided. Israel is divided over this question, the Palestinians are divided, and it will take very strong and effective and committed leadership to reach an agreement and see that it's implemented.
If asked by a president, would you return to the Middle East as the American envoy?
I am a very lucky person to have been born in the United States. My parents were very poor, had no education. I was very lucky to get an education, and I believe strongly that any American, and certainly I, would do anything any president asked me to advance the interests of the United States.
In negotiations, what quality, what factor is the most difficult to maintain?
Patience in the face of hostility, stonewalls set up by people, walkouts by people, deliberate obstruction by people. You have to stick with it. You have to be willing to not take each no for a final answer. One of the interesting things that I see now often, some political leader says, well, I'll never do that. And people say, well, that's it. We can't proceed. Well, political leaders say that all the time. You can't take the first, the 10th, or even the 100th no for an answer. You have to stick with it. If you believe in what you're doing and you're committed to achieving the result, no matter the obstacles, no matter the setbacks, you have to stay with it and keep at it.
One of your pieces of advice for negotiating is to anticipate chance, even without knowing when and how it will occur. Give us an example of that.
Well, first, let me say generally, no human life is lived on a straight line. Every person has a life that zigs and zags and goes forward and goes backward and meets failure and has unexpected opportunities that weren't planned. That's happened repeatedly to me, one of which is my appointment to the Senate. I was appointed as a federal judge in Maine and was a judge for less than a year. As you know, it's a lifetime appointment. I fully expect that I would spend the rest of my life there. And then by an incredible circumstances, I became a United States senator. What happened was that the Iranians had a revolution. They took Americans as hostages. President Carter authorized a military mission to try to rescue the hostages, which failed. The mission had been opposed by the Secretary of State, Cyrus Vance. And for that and other reasons, Vance resigned. Carter then appointed to replace Vance Senator Edmund Muskie of Maine as Secretary of State, and that created a vacancy in the Senate. The governor of Maine appointed me to fill that vacancy. Now, who could have predicted any one of those events, let alone all of them occurring in rapid sequence? That was chance. That was a very tough decision for me because I loved being a federal judge. I loved living in Maine. my tenure in the Senate was uncertain, in contrast to a lifetime appointment as a federal judge. But chance came along. I took the opportunity and was lucky the way things worked out.
What's your best achievement so far as a negotiator?
I think my best achievement as a negotiator was my 6 years as Senate Majority Leader, in which we, in bipartisan fashion, I might add, enacted a good bit of important legislation. The Northern Ireland Peace Agreement, of course. But I think if I drop negotiator out of the question, the most meaningful thing I've done is that when I left the U.S. Senate, I established a scholarship fund for needy students from Maine. I had in mind my own life. I was 16 years old when I graduated from high school. My father was out of work. The chances of my going to college were very slim. But several people gave me a helping hand that lifted me up and enabled me to go to a fine college in Maine and get an education. And I've been lucky since then. And I know there are thousands of kids in my home state and millions around the country who are in similar circumstances, have talent that hasn't yet been uncovered, ambitions that haven't yet been realized. And so I established a program, and I now give out a scholarship each year to a graduate of every high school in Maine. And since need is a factor, about two-thirds of them are the first members of their family ever to go to college. They do very well, and it's gratifying and heartwarming to be able to repay to the society from which I receive so much something to help others move along in life as well.
At age 81, do you ever think about retiring?
Well, I can't because I when I retired from the Senate, I got married, and I have teenage children. So I've got to work till I'm about 109 to get them through college.
Right.
And I believe that retirement is a highly individual thing. My parents were uneducated. They worked at hard manual labor. My mother worked nights in a textile mill for 40 or 50 years. My father was a laborer and a janitor. It made sense for them to retire at 65. They were worn out by that time. But nowadays, the work that many people engage in is not hard manual and physical labor. It's mental. And I think that mentally you're better off to keep going. Yes. I work full-time. I practice law full-time. I represent clients from all around the world. And I have no intention of quitting until I'm either mentally or physically incapable of performing the job. And so far, luckily, that's not the case.
That's a great answer. To what do you attribute this lifetime of achievement that you've created?
I wrote this book to answer that question. First and foremost, my parents. They were not educated. They worked very hard. They died penniless. But in their minds, they were successful because they had a dream which they realized, and it was that their five children would go on to college, get an education, and lead better lives than they had. Each of us did, and we have led lives that would be completely beyond the imagination of my parents. So really, first and foremost, my parents. Secondly, that my good fortune to be an American. My mother was born in Lebanon, emigrated to the United States as a teenager. My father's parents emigrated from Ireland to the United States. He was born in Boston, but he never knew his parents and was raised in an orphanage there. I'm very lucky that they both ended up in America, and I was born in America, and every day I thank my lucky stars for it. I had a brother who was a Marine, two who were in the Navy. I was in the Army. We battled it out for years over which one was more important, but I regard my service in the Army as one of the highlights of my life. I really, truly felt I was doing something for my country. Still feel that way today, yes. He kept telling the rest of us, the Marines are the best. You guys in the Army, you're nothing. And my two brothers who were in the Navy, of course, felt the same way. But I defended the Army, and I still do.
Let me ask you one last question. What job taught you to listen more and speak less?
Senate Majority Leader. The definition of a senator, of course, is someone who talks. You talk almost all the time when you're a senator, and I worked hard in my first few years in the Senate to live up to that reputation and expectation. But when I became Senate Majority Leader, much of my advocacy was in small groups, one-on-one or one-on-three, trying to persuade senators to vote a certain way. And I made the startling discovery over time that the less I talked, the more persuasive I was. The more I listened, the more I understood their concerns. So that really taught me the value of genuinely listening, which is not an easy task. Concentrating fully on what someone else is saying. And if there's a lesson I would impart to the listeners, it is that you have to listen, and especially listen hard to those who don't agree with you or who you don't like. Our minds are set up in a way that we receive and retain very well information that agrees with our prior beliefs. We don't do that with information that doesn't agree with our prior beliefs. So you have to make an extra effort, a really hard effort, to listen, consider fairly and fully the views of those who disagree with you or who don't like you or you don't like, because separate the person from the statement or the idea. The idea may make sense, even though the person isn't the best.
Senator, is there anything else you'd like to add about your book?
No, thank you, except to say I'm very grateful to you for asking me onto your show. I visited Colorado many times, and it's a beautiful place. In fact, it compares in my mind with Maine in terms of beauty, and that's saying a lot.
Thank you. My guest is George Mitchell, author of The Negotiator, published by Simon & Schuster. This is Diana Cordy with Book Talk.